Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello, I am Abby Bayford. Welcome to this week's Nimmers Netter. This week we have a jam-packed show with the Teacher Development Trust talking about online learning, what's new and what's here to stay. As ever, we seek to expand our listeners' perspectives by sharing the books, films and music we are engaged in. This week, I am reading Yoko Ogawa's The Memory Police, which is a surreal surveillance state page-turner about what happens when people's freedom to think, feel and remember is threatened. I also wanted to add in an art recommendation and would encourage everyone to check out the National Portrait Gallery, where they are showcasing BAME artists' work. In the main interview this week, I will be interviewing Hal Roberts, author of the books Oops! Helping Children Learn Accidentally, and co-author along with Deborah Kidd of Uncharted Territories Adventures in Learning. In the interview, Hal explains why he's chuffing buzzing about coining the neologism botheredness and what it means to cultivate botheredness in our classroom. Hal also reads an extract from his new book exclusively for the Nimmers Netter listeners. So without further ado, let's get into this week's Netter and start talking to teachers.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Teacher Development Trust section, learning from the team at TDT on best practice CPD with research.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
In today's TDT segment, we have David and Bethan discussing online learning and our module in leading teacher development for the University of Buckingham's new online MA.
Thanks, Michelle. I thought today we could explore the topic of online learning, which in the last few months has just taken off extraordinarily. And when we've looked at the number of opportunities available out there, professional development, all sorts of online learning and resources, it's just exploded. Bethan, what do you think about this new trend? Everyone's been engaging in online learning. Do you think it's just for the pandemic, or do you think this is something that's going to last?
That's a great question. Thank you, David. It's incredibly interesting that the opportunities have been there during the pandemic to meet the needs of professional learning. And it's really great that there's been so much engagement with it. I do think it is important that we reflect on what this looks like in the long term in a way to really support the work that's happening in schools and the work that's happening with pupils in classrooms as well. So obviously technology provides fantastic solutions to problems that real world and face-to-face learning can't necessarily solve, whether that be seeing input from experts that are on the other side of the ocean, or whether that be seeing examples of best practice that you may not be able to see in your specific setting. There's so many fantastic opportunities that online learning provides, not to mention being able to fit within a busy school day and the teacher or the leader being able to choose the most appropriate time to engage with the learning. And I think it's really important that we reflect on how this can take a more structured and meaningful part of professional learning moving forward, rather than it being something that teachers find and engage with when they're interested.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that fact that people have perhaps consumed this sort of content as one-offs before, but they're looking for something a bit more structured. And it feels to me like people are more inclined to now see collaboration going on online and engaging with material in more depth online. And like you, I share that concern, I suppose, that if all we did through this pandemic was sort of consume one-offs, it won't necessarily make a big impact. And I think thinking of structured courses is really interesting here. And obviously, one of the things that I know you and I are very excited about is getting engaged in this new online master's with the University of Buckingham. And this is interesting because, it predated COVID, and it's been a very exciting project we'd already been thinking about doing online. And yet, my feeling is there will be more people inclined to engage with online learning or to consider a purely online course simply because of their experience having been pushed into it. Before we talk a bit more about it, Bethan, just maybe you want to share a few of the dazzling names who have been producing modules for this.
Yes, absolutely. And so we're obviously really excited about this project, and it just so happened to time with the world getting a bit more familiar with online learning as well. But so some of the other key modules that will form the Masters for Teaching and Learning, which is all online, so it could be taken by anyone, possibly anywhere in the world. So there is assessment in schools, so that's with Professor Robko and Professor Stuart Kine, the evidence-based education team. There is the science of learning with evidence-based education as well, and many others, including evaluating education policy with Becky Allen, looking at educational systems and comparing them in different countries with Lucy Crean. There is a very exciting list, and we're really, really pleased to be in amongst those names.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're rubbing shoulders with all of those names and Doug Limov and Tom Bennett, then it is quite exciting, isn't it? Now, this is an interesting area, of course, is that people are going to be engaging in master study in order to both further their careers, in order to pursue their interests in education, and also to make some difference in their schools. And I think that list of different modules is interesting because there's some elements about policy, there's some elements about enacting change in your pedagogy, and then there's some things which are more around leadership. So whether it's around changing assessment systems, or in our module's case, more around how you actually develop colleagues and create this change in your institution, it feels like you can choose a route through that will be more classroom-based, more leadership-based, or more sort of practice and policy-based. So let's talk a little bit about the bit that I'm ridiculously excited about, which is our online module. You've spent a lot of your time recently, I'm going to say head in your laptop, which sounds really weird, but really buried in this particular framework. So dazzle us with a few of the highlights from the excitements from this particular module.
Yes, indeed. So my head is now slightly removed from my laptop, so I can reflect on the bigger picture. But the aim of this module generally is to prepare leaders or aspiring leaders to be able to develop their colleagues, to improve the impact they're having on people outcomes and in an evidence-informed way. So we've spoken to lots of incredible thinkers in this field, and so there's interviews with people such as Professor Dylan William and other leaders in schools talking about how we can create environments where teachers are thriving and they're supporting pupils. So the purpose of this module is not only to share the research in this area, but to take students through the process of realising this change in their setting. So they'll start by exploring the research, summarising their understanding of it, and then reviewing their organisation and creating a plan for how they can change and bring their setting more in line with what the research is suggesting, and thinking about how they can champion this work in the sector and with colleagues in their school. So we're really, really excited about the impact that this can have within individual settings, but also encouraging colleagues and students to speak about the importance of professional development for schools and for the sector more widely.
And it's a 30 credit master's module, which is interesting, isn't it? And I know you and I and our other colleagues at TDT have spent quite a lot of time exploring how schools are investing in masters and accreditations and all sorts of courses, and how they're supporting people to do that. And I think it's very interesting, these different models where in some places people are self-funding, but their school is giving them release time and occasionally some cover to engage. In other cases, schools are part funding or even fully funding these modules, and sometimes in return are saying, great, but we'd like you to really align some of your work to development plans. And reflecting on this content that's in our module, you could really see how a school could say, right, we've got a particular piece of professional learning, or we've got an area of staff development we want to improve. We'll support you in doing this 30 credit module, and in return, you can then have lots of impact in the school. And actually, I think not only does that really work for us in terms of delivering the module, but I think that probably works for both participants and schools better, because that means they're aligning the processes going on with that person, the learning and the impact. And of course, that means that leaders are empowering people taking this module to actually make change, which means they'll be able to try out the ideas and make the change. So it's really interesting taking those ideas from what we're seeing going on in schools and applying it here. And I guess I'd hope that people, leaders or teachers listening to this, would consider those sorts of models, because I think they're more likely to have impact, aren't they?
Absolutely, and the way that this module has been designed is we recognise the experience of taking an online course can sometimes be an individual experience, whereas we've really tried to think about placing it within a wider school context. So there are activities for the student to speak to colleagues, to engage colleagues in some activities, though intent the chain be more active, but so that they're also sharing their work and their findings, and it is very visible within the school setting. And of course the plan will be to be used in the school so that there can be that wider impact with pupils and colleagues.
I think you and I again have lost count of the number of times people have complained about NPQs to us where they say, I did this project but it was all theoretical and it didn't really have the impact. And so we are obsessed in a lovely way, but we are obsessed about change, aren't we? And change management, getting buy-in from colleagues, designing something that won't just be one person desperately ramming through a change, but something that's sort of embedded. And so through this process then, anyone who engages with this, you'll do a portfolio, you'll create a portfolio of including a practical plan, but you'll also be reviewing literature. You've got some wonderful research luminaries explaining that to you and me. And Bethan guiding you along the way and other colleagues. So we hope it should be something really exciting. And Michelle, where can people find out more information?
Thank you, David and Bethan. If you would like to find out more information on how to apply, then go to tdtrust.org/uob-online-ma.
And I'm very excited to host my first Nailers Natter. As it's the first, I wanted to start with a bang. Hopefully only a metaphorical one though, because I'm using Phil Naylor's microphone and he's put a huge amount of faith in me today. I'm very excited to introduce my guest, Hal Roberts, author of the books Oops, Helping Children Learn Accidentally, and co-author along with Deborah Kidd of Uncharted Territories, Adventures in Learning. I first met Hal at a Hayes discussion dinner where, along with Deborah Kidd, he regaled us with stories about his experiences of teaching. But what struck me, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to interview Hal today, is that despite now reaching the dizzy heights of educational speaking, he has never lost the reality of the classroom and puts children and young people and teachers at the epicentre of all of his work. So I'm very excited he's agreed to be the guinea pig for my Nailers Natter podcast debut. So thank you, Hal.
Hey.
So no pressure, but it's got to be a good one. And just before I pass over to Hal, I want to share a study I read recently by linguistic experts at the University of Manchester who found that local accents are dying out and that strong accents are deemed less professional. So, before we start, I want to reassure the Nailers Natter podcast listeners that there are no weak accents in this podcast and that Hal and I were clearly not subjects of this study. So, Hal, what do you think? Should we be proud of our accents?
Abby, can I just say it's brilliant to be asked to do this. I hadn't really contemplated the fact that I was a guinea pig today, but I'm quite happy to be it. And I love the opportunity to just sit and chat about what it is we all do and try and make sense of it all. So thank you for the invite. Accents are funny things, aren't they? And I'm actually from Lancashire. I'm actually from Bury in Lancashire. So if I ever go home, I can, and I'm with my old school pals, I might sometimes end up talking a little bit like this, you know, and I'll find myself absolutely drifting into an accent I never had as a kid, because my parents were very, very Welsh. So I was born and brought up in Lancashire, but at home my parents would speak Welsh all the time. So my sort of the accent that I received as a very, very small boy, you know, 0 to 3, was sort of this kind of, I don't know, English with Welsh overtones. And my mum would ask me questions in Welsh and I would answer in English. So we'd have the, so, and I still do that with my mum now. She'll still talk in Welsh and I can answer in English. I recognise the sounds. But when I'm working, for example, in my day job now, when I'm working in Wales, I still have that ear, but I'm not very good at, I can't do the conversation stuff. So it leads to some funny moments. When I went to uni, I went to a place called Bretton Hall College, which was absolutely a wonderful place to study. And that's down the road from where I live now. It's known as the Yorkshire Sculpture Park now, but it was actually a university, and I went there. So as an 18-year-old, I moved from Lancashire over to Yorkshire, and as I became immersed in my new surroundings, I sort of chameleon like I kind of just became a Yorkshire person, I guess. And then I love it. And you know, fast forward to teaching in a town centre school in Barnsley, which really has left its fingerprints on my whole professional life and much of my personal life as well. I feel very much at home now in Yorkshire, and I absolutely love the accent that surrounds me here. But when I go down to the Midlands, I love listening to the various accents, like your accent and some of my friends down there. Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm going to read that study, but I'm a bit disappointed they didn't interview us because I feel like I've got a lot to say about it.
I agree. Maybe we could do a shout out to Manchester University and they could include us in the study for next time.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, just Manchester. I mean, my brother is older than me and he's got a real Manc accent. So we're like not chalk and cheese, but I'm now like, yes, isn't it awful, you know? You know, I'm very Yorkshire, and I go and see him, and he's like, "All right, our kid, how's it going?" You know, he's like some sort of late middle-aged Oasis wannabe.
I was going to say, this sounds like a Liam Gallagher impression.
Well, there it is. That's my brother.
So, just as a seamless transition from accents. Surely for drama teachers, it's the best performance tool, having an accent.
It's got me out of a lot of trouble. Even now it gets me out of trouble, I think. I think because when I work down south, which I do a lot, my northern accent gets thicker, I think, in every sense. And I don't do it on purpose. It just happens because I think people trust the northern accent. It's why you get Geordies on call centres. It's why they've built call centres all over Barnsley. They shut all the mines and built call centres. They're like the new mines now because, you know, the Yorkshire accent, just as an example of a northern accent, it's to be trusted, you know? Yeah. It's to be trusted. So as a teacher, yeah, I think the reason I became more Yorkshire is because it was actually a behaviour management tool to be on a wavelength with the kids I were teaching. If I'd ended up teaching in, I don't know, if I'd taught in, I don't know, Newcastle, I would have drifted that way with my accent, you know.
Maybe this could be the next book, Behaviour Management and Accents.
I think it's an overlooked area. There's going to be a lot of behaviour management gurus looking at that when they hear this. I think it's the future.
Maybe. So, did you always want to be a teacher?
No, absolutely not. Last thing on the list.
Really?
Yeah, I tried everything. I tried gardening for a living in the... And I tried, I had numerous jobs. I loved working behind a bar, absolutely loved that, listening to people's stories and chatting on. And I don't know, I worked in a pub for a year, just in my holidays, sorry, when I was studying. When I go home, I'd work, and sometimes I'd do the weekend shift. So I'd be in uni at the week, and then I'd go home and go and help out. because there was a load of factories around the pub, and it was always great going there, you know, when they were clocking off, because they'd all come for a drink, and I'd be the young lad behind the bar, and I'd love listening to their stories of, and so working in the hospitality trade was really attractive. I also had aspirations that I wanted to write and perform and stuff like that. I was playing in pit orchestras. I earned money doing that, playing the double bass and in lots of pit orchestras around Manchester and the Northwest. And I was only young, you know, 17, 18, 19 doing that. And I thought there's loads of stuff I could be doing. And then I realised one day that actually, and this is right at the beginning of the 90s, Abby, right? So I realised then that actually there wasn't much call for poets. You know, I was doing an English degree and it was like, what do you do with that? Who gives a toss about what you know about Tessa the d'Urbervilles? No one. It transpired. Pardon? You do. you're all right now with it, but in the night, there was no one to sort of say to you, this is what you should do. Because I was actually interested. I'll tell you the other thing I was interested in was, I've always been interested in cinema. So I worked as a cinema usher as well. That was one of the UK's first multiplexes. A Warner Brothers cinema. I worked there for, I quite like that. They offered me a management role and I thought, I love this. See films every day. You know what you like when you're young. and so I even tried grave digging. I did that for a bit, but I don't really want to talk. It was horrible. So it was a bit depressing, but I did that and nearly got arrested. But that's another story.
That's podcast two.
Yeah, let's leave that one. I need to write about that one day. But it was, so I tried lots of stuff, but the realisation, the cold dawning of I'm doing my degree, I've done my exams and I'm waiting for the results. That summer, it was, or heading into that summer, realising that the idyllic days that I'd enjoyed at the place I was studying at Bretton Hall, I realised that was coming to an end. And around me, there were drama teachers setting up theatre companies. And I was an English student because my dad, who was a brilliant bloke, but he didn't want me to do drama. So I respected his wishes because he was sort of helping me out with money and that to go to uni. Mm-hmm. It was a cold thought of what was I going to do in September. So I went, there was no careers advice at uni at that time. There was nothing, there was no pathways. You got your English degree. I didn't know what a master's was. I didn't know anything about that. And everything seemed to cost money. So apart from doing a PGCE. Now, a lecturer of mine called Alan MacDonald, who was just Dr. Alan MacDonald, a great bloke, he said, just do a teaching qualification. And it was the last thing I wanted to do. My dad were a teacher. My mum was a teacher. And they were great teachers, my mum and dad, and they were well-liked and everything. But I didn't really, that's not what I wanted. But necessity called, and I found myself enrolled on a PGCE in English at Bretton College. So I could stay on a year, live where I were living. So things didn't need to change too much. So I didn't run off to the big city. I didn't run off to the big smoke. I didn't go abroad. Didn't do anything exciting. I just signed up and thought, let's see what will happen. So no, I didn't want to be a teacher.
You're glad you'd made the transition to teaching, I presume.
Yeah, it's informed my whole life. And it's not what I thought it was. And there's almost too much to say about it, particularly because it just everything, the friendships, the collegiality. Just yesterday, an ex-pupil of mine just got in touch saying, I'm back home, love to see you again, should we all go out for a drink, you know, reunions. I feel like, you know, the impact, I feel the impact now of the way I was as a teacher 25 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and the sad thing is many teachers, I don't want to get depressing, but many teachers don't get that chance because it's too hard and they leave. And it is hard being a teacher, and it's harder now, perhaps in some ways, than it was for me when I first became a teacher. However, there are more straightforward things these days than there were when I became a teacher as well. So I have got rose-tinted spectacles a lot of the time, but also, like you indicated in your introduction, my feet have always been on the ground. And sometimes people might hear a snippet of what I say and think I'm some sort of dreamer or idealist, or I'm not in touch with the real world, but I very much am. I just really want to seek an educational system that does fulfill the dreams of the teachers delivering it, if that makes sense. So that's what informs my work now. But yeah, just it was it's lovely to know your impact, isn't it? And you know, you can have an impact just by teaching a good lesson and having a kid saying that we're all right, which I always saw as a win. That we're all right, that's it. Thanks.
The ultimate goal, isn't it, when you teach?
Yeah, but we've got to be careful, because if that was just like a 10-second snippet, everyone would, you know, it's an absolute eye roller, that one, isn't it? People go, oh, God. Yeah, but there's a truth to it, surely.
Yeah. Talking of hardships and struggles in teaching, you shared with me a story about setting up a drama department, and I wondered if you would just share that experience with the listeners.
Yeah. I taught in a school in Wakefield, and it was a great school to cut my teeth, and I made lifelong friends there. It was 3 years basically, and in my third year I was an English teacher, and I was kind of a drama teacher as well, because there was a drama department there. And I enjoyed doing the drama. I was sort of getting my kicks out of doing the drama. I enjoyed doing the English as well. And I learned a lot about behaviour management, because I was the NQT. It was those days when, if you're an NQT in secondary, they just gave you all bottom sets. You know, it was kind of test your mettle, you know, because if you couldn't do it, there was someone else waiting to do your job in those days. And so I learned quite a lot then. And not realizing what I was going to end up doing in my life, but that, you know, if I just think about being there and doing it, I really enjoyed it. And teaching drama was just wonderful. And, you know, getting theatre groups in and having free rein, really, on no money, with no money, but just going for it. And I went to see my head teacher, who was a good guy, you know, old school. I went to see him at the Wakefield school and said, I'm hungry for something else to do. Just give me a job to do. And I've always liked that. I've always liked being commissioned, if you like. So even as a 3 years into my career, or 2.5 years in, just give me something to do. And what he heard me say was, give me more money. But I wasn't bothered about it. I want orientation. That didn't cross my mind, to be honest. I, you know, it was the old days when you could get an house for 40 grand. Do you know what I mean? And so I'd got an house. I were buzzing me. I had a mortgage and I was 20, 26 or something. And it were like, I don't want money. I just want to give me something to do. Nowadays, someone might say, well, could you take care of the CPD program, or could you have a look at NQTs? That would have been perfect for me. Absolutely perfect. But he was just talking about money. And said they want anything. And I just thought, right, I'm going. In my head, not stroppy, not, well, screw you then, but very just like, okay, oh, that's weird. All right, I'm going to have to move. And there was a teacher in the school whose daughter went to a school in Barnsley, and he said, you know what, they're looking at setting a drama department up at this school. There's a job that's, the closing date's gone. It's today. And this was like May the 17th. And I was like, oh, no. So I rang the school and said, look, I'm really interested in setting up a drama department. And they said, all right, we've had lots of applicants. And they were lying, aren't they? and they said, will you come and teach a class and we'll watch you? But it were half term. And I said, but it's half term. They said, no, we'll get some kids in. So I rock up in my half term at this school. I reckon this would happen quite normally now, but in those days it didn't. And I rocked up and there was a deputy head there called Jenny Salmon, who was mint, absolutely mint. And she was drama, but she didn't tell me that. She was like, we want to see you teach a drama lesson now. We've got these kids in. And basically they bribed these kids with like, Mr. Freeze's chocolate. They'd proper gone to town with these kids. And I just taught a lesson and I knew I'd got it because the kids were just ace. And when I looked around this class, it was just this diverse group of kids from all sorts of backgrounds, because it was a proper town centre school. So it drew from, if you like, and it never changed. It drew from a challenging, challenged community on one side of the town, and then just across the border, just a sort of more affluent cohort. So you got this great mix of kids who mixed really well, and I had them there, and I just knocked it out of the park. I know I did because I got the job, and they were just dead chuffed because I think I'd just solved the timetabling issue. That's basically it. I'd solved it, and they were really buzzing about it. So I got in, and I met the head of music. Music was buzzing at the school. Charlie Brammer, he music was massive. It was like proper brass band culture. And the thought was, we need to build drama and then we'll build dance. So fast forward a couple of years, I'm teaching a bit of music. I'm head of drama. I've got two drama teachers working full time under me. And I'm teaching a couple of lessons of Key Stage 3 dance, which was fairly traumatic for me.
I imagine. Is there any video footage of this? I'd really watch it.
Yeah, I loved doing dance. It was ace. It was ace. And I had to get the kit on. I felt like a PE teacher. It was mad because I'm the most un-PE person there is. I was always last to get picked.
Oh.
You know. No, I wasn't. I was second to last, probably. But yeah, so that's how the drama thing kicked in. And I'd not had any sort of formal, I don't know, theatrical training, or, you know, I had to learn on the job, as it were. And a few years later, a brilliant head, the old head teacher was brilliant. And then a new head teacher came in, and he was a drama specialist. So he really went to town with what we were doing. Matthew Milburn, he was called. And he got Dorothy Hefker into school, who is some of your listeners will recognise that name. She basically invented something called Mantle of the Expert. And that's how I met Deborah Kidd, who came in as a consultant, who was working at Manchester Met at the time. Because we were going to town and doing some proper work on our curriculum. Not doing it for the government, not doing it for Ofsted, doing it so that actually the children would get a really good diet of learning at Key Stage 3. And that was the thing. That was the game changer for me as a professional.
I mean, you speak with so much passion for teaching. It's clear how much you love it. But do you think anyone can teach?
Oh, that's a sideways question. Well, it's interesting that, Abby, because I've been pondering this quite a lot. I think it's been a lockdown thought. I've been thinking about a lot of things, like us all, I'm sure, during lockdown. I think for me, you can train to teach, and we do, I think, you know, we do a pretty good job of offering various routes into what teaching can be. And I participate in all sorts of programs. I support you. I teach on a PGCE. I'm subject lead for drama at Huddersfield Uni. I'll go and contribute to other university routes. I work with trusts. I work all over, and actually I can't find, I mean, people who know more than me might be able to find fault in the pathways, but I think if you've got the right head on your shoulders, you know, you can, a year's training can really serve you well. But I think you've got to be really open to learning and thinking and changing almost. I think, you know, just thinking of my PGCE students I've had over the last few years, they go on a real journey, just like the NQT is a bit of a journey as well. It's like the stabilizers are taken off, aren't they, on your NQT year. But I do think it takes a certain kind of person to be a great teacher. But do you know what? You can be a great leader. You can be an absolutely wonderful leader. And perhaps you found it tough in the classroom sometimes. I don't know. It's so complex, Abby. I'm floundering a little bit because I have been writing about it recently. I think your heart might be in it. You might have absolutely tons of subject knowledge, but if you can't communicate, if you can't get on a class's wavelength, I'm thinking of like hard classes that I've taught, which many of you listeners have taught. You've got to be you've got to be able to shift your stance a little bit, haven't you? I mean, that's what I've been concentrating on. I've been thinking about stance and how we are as teachers. We are knowledge bringers. We are knowledge givers. We are knowledge rich. You know, we absolutely do all that stuff. But also, we've got to be able to shift our stance. You know, I remember teaching a top set group, right, who they'd be setted by manners, a lot of them kids, not necessarily ability. I'm going back, but my stance would be different there compared to perhaps, you know, an English top set group. My stance would be different to a mixed ability year 8 dance class. You know, my stance is different physically, but also mentally. My stance is different. So, I mean, I'm doing a thing tomorrow. I mean, obviously by the time this goes out, it'll be different, but I've done a few online conferences during the lockdown period and during the pandemic. And a lot of my thinking has been, a lot of my presenting is about that idea of how do we protect ourselves into good delivery so that our delivery has an impact? And how do we protect children into complexity? How, for example, do you got kids having in year two, and I know you're secondary, but you'll know in year two, kids have to do the Great Fire of London. They might have to do it in year one. Thing is, it's 1666. How do you deliver that concept without just defaulting to just telling them? How do you actually get them to think about, I mean, you do it through timelines, you do it through stories. That's how I do it. Timelines, stories, placing the kids in a sort of geographical role as well as a sort of dramatic role, a historical role, getting them to really think about the past. Because, you know, for a 7-year-old, the past is playtime this morning. So, we have to shift our stance all the time. And that's something I learned early on. And I worry a little bit, and I'm going back to your question, I promise. I worry a little bit that there's no time to sort of be thinking about that during training. And it's something that's learned as we go on. And unfortunately, some brilliant teachers can become disillusioned. And I'm thinking of friends here, because they haven't thought about, or they've not been given time to consider their own presence, if you like. And this isn't Jazan's, you know, hey, let's all be wild and crazy teachers and do it. You know, this isn't that. This isn't that. This is about being a compelling adult. Mm-hmm. You know, as an English teacher, you want your kids to be immersed in English. But as a leader, when they go to science, you need them to be immersed in science. So who's doing the immersing?
Yeah, right. It's so important that we're flexible, but that we have space to think as well. And we know when you're teaching, there are lots of things you could do that you decide not to do. And for someone watching that practice, all of that decision making, you don't get to see because you're looking at the superficial what, aren't you? So I agree, it's so important we talk about our teaching. And actually, as a trust, we've been encouraging staff to think back to their first year of teaching and write a blog to their NQT self, which is slightly weird when you're writing about yourself in the third person, but we've found a way around it. And I'm wondering, what would you tell Hal the NQT?
that's such a lovely question. And I think now it's what I didn't realise was, that's right, I'm just, just so the listener knows, I haven't been given a lot of time to think about the answers to this. I've not scripted this out. So my reaction is this. There's two things. The first thing, well, there may be three things. I don't know how many things there are, but one thing is that I needed to understand more the varying backgrounds of the children in front of me. Mm-hmm. Now, that seems, now as I sit here approaching 50 years old, that seems very naive, but as a 23-year-old teacher, I hadn't really considered that at all. Mm-hmm. You know, that actually some kids wouldn't have beds.
Yeah.
Some kids would have really, really disastrous relationships with their own families. And I hadn't thought about that. And I'm not saying I totally sorted that in my first year. It took a while. When I went to Barnsley, that's what I learned. I learned that. It hit me in the face. Back to my first back to my NQT year, the other thing I thought was, I realised in that first year, and it's been reiterated to me over the years in a variety of guises, that not everyone thinks like I do. Mm. And I think, even though I'm happy to change my mind and I'm happy to consider other points of view, of course I am, but I think I'm doing my best, and I'm constantly trying to articulate my values around what teaching is. And I didn't really think about that much as an NQT. I gave everything, actually. I want a 3 o'clock merchant. You know, I want jumping in my car at three. I did everything, me. I was Mr. Extracurricular straight away. It wasn't a time when there was more time for that. I still had loads of marking and all that sort of gubbins. You know, I had to teach with different resources. You know, there was no, in those days when I was an NQT, Abby, there were no whiteboard, there were no internet, you know, so it was, you got to have good knowledge yourself. Yeah. I think another message to my NQT self was, yeah, that's important, that not all the adults were the same as me. I learned that. And the other thing would be that, I'd say to my NQT self is keep doing what you're doing in terms of practice. Cause I was curious, inquisitive, and I listened a lot, and do you know what? I respected massively the teachers who'd been doing it longer than me, you know, which now as an older teacher, who's not full time, and you know, some people get really mad that people like me call themselves teachers, but I do teach. You know, I'm not full time. I'm not full time in any school. I don't have the same pressures as, you know, someone teaching 5 days. I don't have the pressures you've got. You know, I don't. I really don't. I have other pressures which will be of interest to nobody, but I do. but I know how it feels. To be that NQT. And when I'm working with my PGCEs, when I'm working with NQTs around the country, around the world, you know, people who've done a teacher training and then they're up on a plane for a couple of years. When I work with those people, what makes me feel good is when they say to me, well, I'm still learning. I'm still not sure. I don't know. Can you help? You know, because when I was an NQT, I needed help. I wanted help. I wanted Dave Matthews, who was a history teacher, to sort of help me with a difficult class by talking to me about it. I needed coaching. I wanted coaching. And coaching is something that has been, it was a bit of a fad, you know, 10 years ago, coaching. But I think we've come to realise now how important it is.
Agreed. And that's what I like about you, how you've never lost your empathy for people in those sort of first years of teaching. And I think that's really important in the work you do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, thanks.
How would you describe your job now then?
Since March, sitting in my attic. My job now is, well, what happened was, Abbe, I was, I taught in the school in Barnsley and I was dead happy. You couldn't have found, if you'd have looked around, you wouldn't have found anyone happier than me in teaching. And teaching, by that time, the real, you know, the current reality we accept as teachers, that was the reality then. It was, we were under pressure, massive pressure as a school around results, huge pressure. Fortunately, I was head of drama and stuff. So drama did all right. I built a media studies department, you know, and I had a lot going on. I was also an advanced skills teacher, which for me, I had my own, I don't know if you know much about that, but basically you had your own Ofsted. Someone came in, they interviewed parents, they interviewed kids. It was all about you. And it were quite frightening, but I absolutely loved it. I got the status of being an AST. I went through a rigorous process, got a load of support off my head teacher, and was basically part of that was I was given a day a week to have an impact either on other schools in our sort of community of schools and do research. So I'm going back now to like 2006, something like that. So I was becoming massive. I was reading books. I was accessing research. I became research informed, which a few years later suddenly became de rigueur and became actually a cause of huge debate and division on place on social media, places like Twitter and stuff. Our research, you know, the head of CPD at my school, which was it was a bit old school. He was a good bloke though. I remember going to him and saying, "I want to buy an education book for everybody, for all heads of department." And he looked at me like I was off my head. He said, "What are you on about?" And I said, "I need £200 to get a copy of this book for everyone." And he asked me what the book was, and it was called Essential Motivation in the Classroom by Ian Gilbert. And I read that book, and it really fired me up. As a teacher, it fired me up, and I wanted everyone to feel that fire, feel the heat of that book. And I thought one day I'm going to sit and have a chat with that Ian Gilbert about his book because it's mint. So he did. I mean, the bloke in charge, he was great, Stuart. He was great. And he just said, "Yeah, go on then, go and buy those books." Because he thought I was being like kind of maverick and doing my AST role, really. And I was. And actually, we brought research, we brought thinking into our heads of department meetings in a way that hadn't happened before. It might have been happening in other schools, but definitely not at this school. Mm-hmm. So that happened. And then I started doing some CPD delivery and being asked to do some as an AST. I started going into primaries a bit more. And spending time in primaries, I had a bit of an epiphany and thought, I want to spend some time with this lot. I love what I'm doing at my school, but I'd love to spend some time here. And then I went to the local PRU, pupil referral unit, and I thought, I want to get stuck in here as well with these brilliant, complex, labelled kids and their staff who were just mint and amazing. And I realised that the only way I could do all three was to pack my job in. And so I had a chat with Maria, my wife, and said, "Can I pack my job in?" And she's a proper maverick, and she just said, "Yeah." no sort of, "But what about the mortgage?" And we you know, we got a little boy and everything. She went, "Yeah, pack it in. You can always go on supply." So I packed me like what was then about a 45 grand a year job. I packed it in.
Wow.
And straight away, you know, I packed it in the, did my leaving speech, and then got some emails saying, "Can you come and do this? Can you come and do that?" Just locally in Barnsley, because the council got wind of my availability. And because my practice was so current, I found myself then with a busy diary. I just wanted to match my salary in that first year or somewhere close to it so that I felt safe. Yeah. I had no idea about working for myself. I didn't go on any sort of business courses. I didn't know anything about it. I just thought, I'll do work and I'll charge them for my time, which is what I did. Hugely inappropriate costings. I was paid, you know, next to nothing for doing full days and stuff. I soon learnt my lesson, like. Mm-hmm. But within that first year,
I realized that the complexity of what we do, and I started trying to articulate it in my own head, the complexities of teaching. I tried my hand at teaching primary. I tried my hand working in the PRU, and I was able to do both. I'm not saying I was an expert, but I was happy to step up. And I think teachers love that. And I still do that now.
So how did you get into writing books?
So I'm like cracking on, and my diary's quite busy, and I'm getting asked. I actually did a lot in Wolverhampton because I got to know Mick Waters, who many of your listeners will know. He was just brilliant. Deborah Kidd, who's lifelong friend now, but she was really helpful getting me started. And Karen Ardley, who was someone who was very supportive of me. And by that, I mean, they just made sure I got I was able to pay my mortgage. They didn't give me any money, but they were looking after me in terms of making sure I was okay, me sort of mental health and everything, because I was frightened most of that first year. Into the second year, I started thinking I need to get some representation. Like, I'm carrying on, and I can carry on, but there must be like an agency that can help me get work. And I went back to Ian Gilbert book. And when I found that, I went and reread it, and I just got in touch with him, with his company online. And by this point, a mate of mine, Jamie Portman, who'd been an AST with me in Barnsley, he's a head teacher now. He'd said to me, get on Twitter. This is 2009. Get on Twitter. So I did. So on Twitter, I started saying, oh, I've had a lovely day working with TAs around behaviour. So I'd get more bookings because people were seeing me on Twitter. And I started travelling more for work. So I'd be getting familiar with the local travel lodges on the M6 and stuff, you know. And eventually I got in touch with Ian Gilbert through Independent Thinking, who are not a speakers agency. They're miles more than that. And they've been really brilliant during lockdown. But I ended up having a meeting with him and essentially got taken on or became part of their group of educationalists. There's head teachers, mat leads, there's comedians, there's all sorts of people on there, independentthinking.co.uk if your listeners want to have a look. And I've been on there for a long time. But when I met Ian, I just told him about the impact he'd had, and he said, have you got a book in you? And I didn't realise they were publishing books and stuff. And I went, of course I have, because I'd be an idiot to say no, wouldn't I? You've got to say yes. And my aspiration, you know, one of my aspirations at uni as an English graduate was going to be to write. I wanted to be a film critic, like I said, but actually I wanted to be Stephen King or James Herbert. I wanted to write horror. Now, they weren't going to publish no horror book about me, but I could spin a yarn. And he just said, write a book. And I said, all right. And so I wrote a book, and I knew, and he said he'd help me with it. So he ended up getting like the editing credit, because I think he had to do a bit of work, because I basically just threw down onto paper 45,000 words about why teaching is ace and why it's also hard. And that became Oops. And it's basically a love letter to teaching and a love letter to Barnsley. And I didn't realise this at the time, but I wanted everyone to read it and really enjoy it and see themselves reflected in it. Now, that's the sort of naive me talking, because, you know, for every 5-star review, you get a 1-star. But I just think, oh, you don't get it, bless you. You know, because I think it's like, it's not hard. Many people read it in one sitting. But the publishers just did a really great job. And Ian Gilbert did a great job of just sort of making it coherent, like I hope I'm being now.
Wow. And I loved reading Oops, and I love Uncharted Territories as well. I just think it speaks to the soul of the teacher. You kind of feel like as you're reading it, you're talking to me, Abby, the English teacher. Yeah. And I like that. It's just a nice way of writing.
I think that's what I wanted. I think I'm a conversational writer. Mm. I'm not academic, although I feel like I am now, only because I got some letters after my name. But I struggled with articulating the thinking behind what I was trying to do and what I was explaining. Does that, oh God, I'm struggling to articulate now. I mean, I did a master's, and the only reason one of the driving forces of me doing a master's was because I was sick of people chucking research at each other as if it was like the golden, I don't know, you know, the golden thing we've all been looking, here it is, this. And actually, it's more complicated than that. And I'm not all over it, but I'm all over it enough to satisfy myself and feel confident to share it with others. So, you know, and I got a distinction in my master's. I can't tell you how proud I was that day when I found that out, because it was so hard to do. I paid for it myself, and I'm not trying to do a sob story now. I'm just saying I paid for it myself. I attended all the lectures I could, and I worked really hard, and I found it dead hard. But when I wrote it, I found it, when I look back on it now, it was a great thing to do. And I find it really, really upped the game on my work that I do now, you know.
That's an amazing achievement. And the achievements aren't stopping. So now you're recording the audio of Oops, is that right? Is that Monday?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm doing it on Monday. Yeah, what happened was, the publisher, I did Uncharted Territories. That was the last book. And I did that with Dr. Deborah Kidd, who's just mint and great. And she's just ace. And she was ace to collaborate with. And we do a lot of work together now. Love her to bits. And the thing is, and I've got another book, I've got it right here in front of me that I'm actually writing, and it's called Botheredness, which I can talk about after. But I thought, when I do like conferences, and when I go into schools, you know, and talk about what I talk about, stories and curriculum and engagement and all those things, people like come to me and they'll say, oh, we like listening to you talking and blah, blah, blah. And I get some nice feedback, you know, and I'm busy, so it must be all right. But something I get back to me is, we'd love you to read Oops. And I've had that for the last few years. And it's funny because we started talking about that to start with today with accents and so on. And I said, well, so I went to the publisher and I said, David, can I do an audio book of Oops? Now, Oops was published in 2012, but it's one of the, and it was published at a time when there weren't lots and lots and lots and lots of education books, which there are quite a lot now. It was kind of, there wasn't as wide a field or broader field, you know, than there is today. And I think it hit a nice nerve. And they were all over it. They said, yeah, get it recorded. I can't believe it's taken me this long to ask them. But I should have just asked them ages ago. So I'm on Monday, I'm off to a recording studio. And what's sweet about that little story is the recording studio is owned by an ex-pupil of mine. So it's great, you know. So he's you know what, he's giving me a bit of discount, you know, because he got his GCSE, you know. But yeah, so it's buzzing. So I'm off there, and that goes back to that idea of impact, you know. As in a teacher, it's great. That's impact right there. So I'm recording that, and I'm dead excited, and that should be out in the autumn for when we all go back.
Do you think this is a really good seamless transition into our podcast competition?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's excellent. Crack on.
Yeah. So we're asking listeners to tweet their advice to NQTs using the hashtag NQTLetter, tagging Hal, so @Hal_Roberts and me, @ATT_Institute. And if you can tweet some advice you would give to NQTs, what we're going to do at the beginning of September is randomly select a winner. And Hal has very kindly agreed to give away a copy of his book, Oops. And you can tweet more than once, so go for it. Fill your boots over the summer with this tweeting. We might regret this, Hal, if we start getting...
I might not answer them all.
But it will be a great thread, great for early career teachers to follow and listen as well. So please get involved when you listen to this.
Yeah, and it'd be a pleasure, that. That's great. And, getting the book out was just ace. And it was a real privilege, and it's something I'm dead proud of. And I mean, anyone who says that they've got all the answers to teaching, or throws some research out and says this is it, they can't be right, can they?
No,
Abby, they can't be. And I think we all know that I'm not right. I haven't got any silver bullets. What I'm realizing, and this is just in the last few years, is that what you do have, though, is experience, you know. And, you know, no one can deny what you've experienced in the classroom. And I would never deny anyone else's experience in the classroom. But what I can do is say, but this is my truth. You know, this is the thing I've found in this context. And I think it's important that as professionals, this is something I've been thinking about over lockdown as well. The best thing to be, the best CPD is talking to each other.
Yeah.
But being open to listen as well, really listen. And I've gained a lot. And I must admit, lurking around Twitter, I've learned a lot from folk who, not, I didn't dismiss anyone, but maybe they, I don't know, maybe they just didn't speak to me, you know. But actually, when I've really listened to them properly and seen what they've been posting, I kind of get it now. And I hope that that's the impact I might have on some people as well.
Yeah. I think it's so important that we respect diversity of thought, and it can be quite a frightening place to put yourself out there and share your experience. But it's important to me that people feel confident enough and brave enough to do that, and know that their voice will be heard and respected, even if people don't agree with them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we've all had moments looking at Twitter, for example, and thinking, flipping heck, do you not like... flipping heck, you sound like you're on drugs, you know. And... and then I look at my own feed and think, I'm posting pictures of how cats should wear trousers. And, you know, but I think, you know, fun and laughing, humour, warmth, those are some key things that, you know, as teachers, we need to embrace. Not snark, no one wants to be awful. Well, some people do want to be awful, I think, but not, and that's not just on Twitter, that's in real life, but open, probably, is warm.
Yeah.
Those are the words.
So before we finish, I've got to talk to you about your book, Botheredness.
All right, have you?
What is botheredness? How would you...
I've got it here. I've written it down in this book I'm writing. It's all here in paper. Botheredness. Here we go. Let me just... I'm just going to have a look through what I've written here. In your class sits Maisie, and she's a real sweetheart. You start in a topic on ancient Greece, and Maisie's so excited because that's where she's going on holiday in the summer. And when you did Romans, it was cool because her family piled into their VW camper van and off they went to Hadrian's Wall for the whole weekend. It's splendid for lovely Maisie. She's buzzing and bothered. Her parents are ace, and fair play to them for being bothered. Amber isn't that bothered, though. Amber hasn't got a bed or a mam. She hasn't really got headspace for Adrian, walls or Greeks. She's got enough on. Besides, these walls and ancients are so long ago, they tell her nothing about her life. They're a mirror that reflects nothing. A challenge for you then, as Amber's teacher, is how are you going to get her bothered? How are you going to make it all matter? And that,
So I just read that off the cuff. That's just the introduction to chapter one about what botheredness is, and it goes on. But it's not supposed to be fluffy or jazz hands or, you know, punch in the air, let's do it for the kids. There is a sense of that, and that's me with my heart on my sleeve. But I know that working as I did in the referral unit in the SEMH school, we had to work very hard as teachers to protect children into the complex demands of the curriculum. We had to show that they were achieving. So we had to get them bothered. Now, some people might call that engagement, but I think engagement is just manners. Yeah. That's all engagement is the meeting of manners. What we have to do as teachers is figure out how we're going to get kids invested. But we've got to be bothered to do that. We've got to adjust our planning. We can't do that brilliant Greg Davis thing of teaching the same lesson across the 5 years. Do you remember Greg Davis, the comedian, saying this? He was a drama teacher for a year, and he just planned one lesson and taught it year 7 to 11, you know, with no adjustments. You know, that's a funny extreme. But we've got to be responding. And again, that goes back to that idea of stance and being that agile adult, I guess. Yeah. So that's that. I mean, I don't know if that explains anything. And some people will just write botheredness off as being a bit of a no word, a bit of a fluffy word and a silly word, and just some stupid thing that people will latch onto. It's not. I don't mean it to be that. I mean business with it.
Mm. And what you've done there is depicted the reality in front of us for many teachers across the country, and the need to be warm, the need for our curriculum to feel relevant, for the children to have an investment in it, ownership of that knowledge as well. So I'm very excited to read it. And when is it out?
I've got to finish it, and I think it'll be the autumn. Well, probably closer to Christmas now. In reality, they may even wait till the new year, because I'll be honest with you, during the lockdown, I were very frightened, because, you know, to speak as just a human being, I make a living to support my family. Mm-hmm. I make my living working with schools in kids' classrooms, working alongside teachers and so on. So that all stopped, and I was very worried. I was frightened. I, you know, in a way that I hadn't been for a long time, and I was very worried. But then I held my nerve, which was some great advice I had off someone once, and that's a good advice, piece of advice for NQTs: hold your nerve. I held my nerve, and the work came in. So I ended up doing a lot of this sort of Zoom online stuff with teams of schools around the country looking at curriculum. I wrote for BBC Bite Size, and I've done some nice little bits of filmmaking, making little stimulus films to provoke writing. Done all that just in lockdown, and fortunately been able to sustain a little livelihood. So I were very grateful for that. So, you know, there is something about holding one's nerve. There's also something about feeling privileged about what you do. And as teachers, you know, on a cold, wet November afternoon, the feeling of being privileged doesn't actually ring very true. But I think we need to just keep it in our minds, keep it aligned with our values, that actually teaching and being involved in education, be it working at a university, supporting, you know, leadership in a mat somewhere, it's a privilege to do it. And we mean it. And I think, you know, as I say again, and I've said it a couple of times on this cast, I'm not teaching full time in a classroom, but I get it. And I have the privilege of standing alongside those people who are properly doing it, and I don't take that lightly.
Oh, thank you. That was a perfect note to end on. Thank you for making my first interview so effortless. We had longer. Maybe we need a part two at some point.
Thanks.
That'd be great.
Thanks for having me along. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. And to the listeners, if you haven't read Hal's books, they're a perfect read over the summer as we gear up for our September start. So please check them out. And Hal, thank you again.
Nailers, Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers, Netter, just talking to teachers.